All right, buckle up for a deep dive that might sound a little intimidating at first. Nervous system pharmacology. But trust me, it's way cooler than it sounds in a textbook.
Definitely.
And get this, our source material is this PHAR370M2 companion guide thing. Looks like it's straight out of some university course.
Yeah, it's definitely university level stuff, but we'll break it down, no worries. We're going to zero in on the autonomic nervous system,
Okay.
the somatic nervous system, and how all sorts of drugs can mess with these systems, basically.
We'll even get into substance use disorders, the science behind addiction. It's seriously fascinating stuff.
Really is. It shows how much we still don't know about the brain and
Yeah.
how drugs can, hijack it almost.
Okay, so before we get all deep into the weeds with the pharmacology side of things, let's start with the basics.
Yeah.
The nervous system is basically our body's control center, right?
Yeah, pretty much. It's constantly watching everything that's going on inside and outside,
Yeah.
and it's making adjustments all the time to keep us running.
Like a.
Like a conductor in an orchestra.
Yeah. Okay, so the nervous system is responsible for what? Recognizing, processing, and reacting to every single
Right,
change
every single change in the environment. Yeah.
that's happening.
Think about it this way. Temperature drops, you start feeling cold.
Mm.
Your nervous system, that's what tells your body, hey, we got to shiver, got to warm up.
Right, like our own personal thermostat almost.
Exactly. Now, inside this control center, we've got three main parts. Okay.
Okay.
There's the central nervous system, the brain and spinal cord, kind of like the headquarters.
The big bosses.
Yeah, exactly. Then we've got the peripheral nervous system, which is like the network of messengers. They're running all over the body, carrying signals back and forth.
Right.
And finally, there's the autonomic nervous system. We call it the ANS for short.
ANS.
That's our focus today.
Okay, so the ANS is like the behind the scenes crew, right? Keeping the whole show running without us even realizing it.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. The ANS, it takes care of all those vital functions we don't think about: breathing, heart rate, digestion.
Right.
It's our body's autopilot, basically.
That is wild. So we can breathe and eat and our heart's just doing its thing, all without us having to like consciously tell it to.
Yep. Pretty incredible when you think about it. And even within the ANS, there are two branches, the parasympathetic and sympathetic.
Okay.
They work together like a
Okay.
seesaw to keep everything balanced.
All right, let's break down the seesaw. What's the parasympathetic system all about?
Well, the parasympathetic system, it's all about rest and digest.
Okay.
This is the system that kicks in when you're relaxed, helps you conserve energy, slow things down, your heart rate goes down, blood pressure chills out, digestion ramps up.
So it's like the chill mode of our nervous system.
Exactly. And the star of this show is a neurotransmitter called acetylcholine.
Acetylcholine.
Think of it like the messenger that activates that whole rest and digest response.
So it's the signal that tells our body, okay, time to relax and recharge.
Exactly. And it does that by hitting specific receptors called nicotinic and muscarinic receptors.
Gotcha. So these receptors are like the locks, and acetylcholine is the key that unlocks the rest and digest response.
Perfect analogy. And this is where pharmacology gets really interesting
Okay.
because we can use drugs to tweak these pathways. For example, there are drugs called muscarinic agonists.
Muscarinic
They
agonists.
basically act like acetylcholine, triggering those muscarinic receptors.
So, like giving our body an extra dose of chill,
Oh,
basically.
exactly. And these muscarinic agonists, they have some really interesting uses in medicine. For instance, they can treat glaucoma.
Oh, wow.
Glaucoma is that condition where pressure builds up in the eye, right?
Right.
These drugs help drain the fluid, lower the pressure.
So by targeting those specific receptors, we can actually help save someone's vision.
Pretty much, yeah. And muscarinic agonists can also be used for things like weak bladder muscles.
So we can use drugs to fine-tune these involuntary processes. That's pretty incredible.
It really shows the power of understanding how these systems work.
Yeah.
Now, there's another kind of drug that acts on this system, anticholinergic drugs.
Anticholinergic drugs.
They block acetylcholine from doing its thing at those muscarinic receptors.
So it's like they're putting up a do not disturb sign on those rest and digest receptors.
Exactly. And these anticholinergics, they've
Okay.
got a bunch of uses too. Like in respiratory problems, they can open up airways. In urinary issues, they relax the bladder. And for GI problems, they can reduce spasms.
So we can either boost or block the parasympathetic system with drugs, depending on what we're trying to do.
You got it. It's all about understanding that balance those systems,
Yeah.
how we can tweak them for, therapeutic benefit. Now, let's switch to the other side of the seesaw. Sympathetic nervous system.
Okay, so if parasympathetic is rest and digest, sympathetic's got to be fight or flight, right?
You got it. This is what kicks in when you're stressed, when there's danger.
Right.
It preps your body for action. Heart rate goes up, blood pressure spikes, even your pupils get bigger to take in more light.
Like our body's alarm system going off.
Exactly. And just like the parasympathetic system has acetylcholine, mm-hmm. the sympathetic system relies on norepinephrine.
Okay, norepinephrine. So that's the messenger that tells our body, get ready for action.
Yeah, exactly. And it does that by activating two main types of receptors, alpha and beta.
Alpha and beta receptors. This is where it starts to get a bit complicated.
It can seem that way, but think of it like this. Alpha receptors are like the clenching receptors.
Okay.
When they're activated, they usually cause things to constrict, like your blood vessels, GI tract.
Right.
You know how your pupils dilate when something scary happens?
Yeah.
That's those alpha 1 receptors in action.
So the same receptors that are helping us like survive danger are also involved in, you know, controlling blood flow and digestion.
Exactly. Now, beta receptors, they're more like the relaxing receptors.
Okay.
When they're activated, they usually make things relax, except in the heart, where they actually ramp up heart rate and how strongly it pumps.
Ah, okay, so it's not always a simple on-off switch. These receptors can do different things depending on where they are in the body.
Exactly. And like with the parasympathetic system, we have drugs that can either mimic or block those sympathetic responses.
So we can use drugs to either boost or block the fight or flight response.
Exactly. And this has some really important uses, like epinephrine, which activates both alpha and beta receptors. It's a lifesaver in situations like anaphylaxis.
Anaphylaxis is a severe allergic reaction, right?
Yeah.
So epinephrine is basically giving the body a supercharged fight or flight boost to fight that allergic reaction.
Exactly. And we also use drugs that target these receptors to control heart rhythm, open up stuffy noses, dilate pupils for eye exams, even treat asthma by relaxing the airways. It's a pretty diverse range of applications.
Wow. It's amazing how we can manipulate these systems to treat so many different things.
It really is.
Yeah.
Now, on the flip side, there are drugs called antiadrenergic drugs.
Antiadrenergic.
They block those alpha and beta receptors, basically hitting the brakes on the sympathetic system.
So if we need to calm down an overactive fight or flight response, that's where these drugs come in.
Exactly. They're used for a variety of things, like treating a tumor called pheochromocytoma.
Pheochromocytoma.
Yeah. It causes your body to produce way too much epinephrine and norepinephrine. By blocking those receptors, we can help get those hormones back under control.
Like hitting the pause button on that runaway alarm system?
Exactly. They can also help with benign prostatic hyperplasia, which is basically an enlarged prostate.
Okay.
It relaxes the muscles in the prostate and bladder. And then there are beta blockers, which specifically target beta receptors.
Yeah.
They're used for angina and congestive heart failure because they reduce the workload on the heart.
So I've got drugs targeting these receptors for heart problems, prostate issues, even tumors.
It shows how far-reaching the effects of the sympathetic system are and how we can use drugs to, you know, modulate it, basically.
Okay, all this talk about blocking the sympathetic system, are there any side effects we should be aware of?
There can be. One common one is orthostatic hypotension.
Orthostatic hypotension, that sounds not good.
It's basically dizziness when you stand up.
Oh, okay.
It happens because the drugs can interfere with how your blood vessels normally constrict, leading to a drop in blood pressure.
So your blood vessels don't tighten up properly when you stand and you get that head rush feeling.
Exactly. That's why it's so important to understand how these drugs work and use them carefully.
This is all so fascinating. We've gone from this big picture of the nervous system down to these tiny little receptors and how drugs can tweak them.
That's quite a journey, right?
It is.
And we've only just begun. So far, we've focused on the autonomic nervous system, which controls those involuntary functions. Now, let's shift gears to the somatic nervous system, the one that lets us move our muscles.
Okay, so this is the system that lets us walk, talk, interact with the world.
Exactly. And unlike the ANS, which has those two neuron pathways,
right.
The somatic nervous system uses a single long motor neuron. It goes straight from the central nervous system to the skeletal muscle.
So it's a more direct line of communication, no pit stops along the way.
Exactly. And where this motor neuron meets the muscle fiber, we have a special junction called the neuromuscular junction.
Okay.
This is where all the action happens.
All right, let's break it down. What's going on at this neuromuscular junction?
Well, the motor neuron releases acetylcholine, just like in the parasympathetic system.
Oh, interesting. So acetylcholine is the messenger for both systems.
It is. But here, it binds to a different type of nicotinic receptor, one that's specific for skeletal muscle. We call it the NM receptor.
So acetylcholine is the same, but it uses different receptors to get different jobs done.
Precisely. And just like with those other systems, we can use drugs to mess with this process too. In fact, there's a whole class of drugs called neuromuscular blocking drugs.
Neuromuscular blocking drugs? That sounds pretty intense. What are they used for?
As the name suggests, they block the signals at that neuromuscular junction, leading to muscle paralysis.
Whoa.
They're mainly used in surgery and other situations where muscle relaxation is super important.
So we can actually use drugs to temporarily paralyze muscles. That's incredible and a little bit scary.
It's a powerful tool, but when used correctly, it's incredibly valuable. Mm. There are two main types, non-depolarizing and depolarizing blockers.
Okay. What's the difference between those two?
Well, non-depolarizing blockers,
like
a drug called tubocarine, they act like competitive antagonists.
Mm.
They basically block acetylcholine from binding to those NM receptors, so the muscle can't contract.
So acetylcholine shows up at the muscle cell ready to make it contract, but the non-depolarizing blocker is like, nope, not tonight.
You got it.
Yeah.
Now, depolarizing blockers work differently. They actually mimic acetylcholine, causing a muscle contraction at first.
Huh.
But here's the catch. They stick around longer than acetylcholine normally would.
Ah.
They're resistant to the enzyme that usually breaks acetylcholine down.
So they cause prolonged activation of those NM receptors. But wouldn't that mean the muscle's constantly contracting?
You'd think so, but it actually does the opposite.
Really?
This prolonged activation, it prevents the muscle from resetting itself. It essentially overloads the system, leading to paralysis.
So it's like flooding an engine with too much gas.
Exactly.
When shut stops working.
And both types of blockers, they both end up causing paralysis, but in very different ways.
Wow. That's mind-blowing. So we've got drugs that can either block acetylcholine or like overwhelm the system with it, and both lead to paralysis.
Exactly. It really highlights how finely tuned that whole process is at the neuromuscular junction.
Yeah.
But even though these drugs can cause paralysis, they're super important medicine.
Okay, so when would we actually use these neuromuscular blocking drugs?
One of the most common uses is during surgery.
Okay.
It allows the surgeon to operate without using crazy high doses of general anesthesia, which can have a lot more side effects.
So it creates a still and stable operating field without over-sedating the patient.
Exactly. They're also used for intubation, you know, putting in a breathing tube.
Yeah.
By temporarily paralyzing the throat muscles, it makes that procedure much easier and safer.
Wow. I never realized how important muscle relaxation was for things like that.
It's crucial. And for some really sick patients who can't breathe on their own, these drugs can help control their breathing while a machine takes over.
This is all so fascinating. It's incredible how something seemingly simple, like a muscle contraction, actually relies on such complex processes.
Yeah, right. And now that we've covered the somatic nervous system and those powerful neuromuscular blocking drugs, let's move on to a topic that's both fascinating and incredibly complex. Anesthesia.
Anesthesia. Now we're talking. I've always wondered how it actually works. It's like temporarily switching off consciousness.
It is remarkable.
Yes.
Anesthesia is basically defined as a state of no sensation.
Right.
And it's not just about blocking pain.
Right.
It's also about amnesia.
So you don't remember anything.
No reflexes.
Okay.
And of course, muscle relaxation.
So it's not just numbing the pain, but making sure the patient is completely unconscious throughout the surgery.
Exactly. We have two main categories. Inhaled anesthetics, which you breathe in, and intravenous anesthetics, which are injected directly into the blood.
Okay, so inhaled anesthetics would be like nitrous oxide laughing gas.
Yes. Nitrous oxide is a great example, although it's often used with other drugs because it doesn't cause complete anesthesia on its own, but it's a great pain reliever.
Yeah.
And it works really quickly.
So it's like a quick and easy way to take the edge off, but not strong enough for major surgery.
Precisely. For more complex procedures, we use stronger inhaled anesthetics, like isoflurane or halothane.
Okay.
They can induce complete unconsciousness.
Right.
But there's a higher risk of side effects, like low blood pressure.
So it's all about balancing effectiveness and safety, depending on the surgery.
Exactly. And then there are intravenous anesthetics, like propofol and ketamine. They enter the bloodstream and reach the brain quickly, inducing anesthesia rapidly.
Propofol, that's what they use for twilight sleep, right?
Yep.
Where you're kind of aware but don't remember anything afterward.
It is. It's often used for minor procedures because the recovery time is quick and there are fewer side effects.
And what about ketamine? I've heard that one can have some interesting effects.
It can. Ketamine is a powerful anesthetic that's often used for kids and patients with blood flow problems.
Okay.
It can also produce a dissociative state, meaning you feel disconnected from reality.
Wow. Intense. So with all these options, how do anesthesiologists choose which type to use?
It depends on a bunch of factors. The type of procedure, the patient's medical history, allergies, and potential drug interactions.
Right, right.
They often use a combo of drugs. It's called balanced anesthesia to minimize side effects and tailor the experience to each patient.
So it's like creating a custom cocktail of drugs perfectly blended for that person.
That's a great way to put it. And besides general anesthesia, which affects the whole body, we also have local anesthesia.
Right. Local anesthesia is for numbing a tooth before a filling or getting stitches. It's amazing how it can block pain in just one spot.
It really is. Local anesthetics work by blocking voltage-gated sodium channels, which are essential for nerves to transmit signals.
Okay.
It essentially prevents those pain signals from reaching the brain.
Like cutting the communication lines between the pain and your brain's awareness of it.
Exactly. And we can give local anesthetics in a few different ways topically, like a cream by local infiltration, meaning injecting it directly into the area,
right,
or through spinal or epidural injections, which can block pain signals in larger areas of the body.
Wow. So many options. Are there any risks with local anesthesia?
Allergies are rare, but they can happen, usually to the preservatives and the anesthetic. A more common concern is systemic toxicity, which can happen if too much gets into the bloodstream.
So careful dosing and administration are key.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Anesthesiologists are highly trained to understand these things and keep patients safe. Now, before we wrap up this part of our deep dive, there's one more topic I want to touch on that's super relevant to pharmacology: substance use disorders.
Substance use disorders. This is a topic that often gets misunderstood, and it's important to talk about it with sensitivity and respect.
Absolutely. Substance use disorder, or SUD, can have a devastating impact on individuals, families, communities.
Right, yeah.
And to really understand it, we need to look at the science behind it.
Yeah. And the source material really emphasizes using respectful language when discussing SUD. We're talking about people here, not just diagnoses.
And SUD is not just one thing. It's diagnosed based on a cluster of criteria.
Okay.
Like social impairment, Rifke use, impaired control, withdrawal, and tolerance.
So it's a really complex interplay of behavior, psychology, and physiology.
Exactly. And it's important to remember that SUD can happen with both prescription and non-prescription drugs.
That's a really important point. It's not just about illegal drugs. Even medications that are prescribed can cause problems if someone develops a dependence on them.
You're absolutely right. And so many different things can influence someone's risk for SUD genes, other disorders they might have, their environment, and even what stage of life they're in. Adolescence and young adulthood are particularly vulnerable times.
This is obviously a really complex issue with no easy answers.
It is.
But understanding the science behind it, that's a really important first step in addressing it.
I agree. And we'll be diving deeper into those complexities of substance use disorders in the next part of our deep dive.
This has been a whirlwind of information, from the basic functions of the nervous system to the complexities of anesthesia and substance use disorders.
It's a lot to take in.
It's incredible how drugs can interact with these delicate systems in our bodies.
It really is. It's amazing how much we've learned about the nervous system,
yeah.
And yet there's still so much more to discover. We've only just scratched the surface.
All right, I'm ready for more. Let's take a break and come back for part two, where we'll explore the science behind tolerance, withdrawal, and addiction.
Sounds good. Welcome back to our deep dive into nervous system pharmacology.
It's wild to think that we can use drugs to target such specific things in our bodies, like having a molecular toolkit.
It really is remarkable. And in this part, we're going deeper into substance use disorders. You know, those SUDs we talked about.
Right, right.
We'll unpack those key concepts, tolerance, withdrawal, and addiction.
Okay, so let's start with tolerance. That's basically when your body gets used to a drug, right?
Exactly.
Like someone who drinks coffee every day might need like 3 cups to get the same buzz.
Yeah, it's like your body's way of adapting to the drug being there. And it does this in a couple of ways. Metabolic tolerance and cellular tolerance.
Okay, so metabolic tolerance. That's kind of like our body's getting really good at breaking down and getting rid of the drug, right?
Exactly. The more you're exposed to a substance, the better your liver and other organs get at processing it.
So less of the drug actually reaches its target, and you need more to feel the same effects. Makes sense.
Now, cellular tolerance.
Yeah.
That's a bit more complicated. It involves changes in how the cells themselves respond to the drug, often by downregulating receptor systems.
Downregulation. So the cells are basically reducing the number of receptors the drug can bind to. Like if you hear a loud noise over and over, you kind of start to tune it out.
Perfect analogy. Imagine your cells have a set point for how active they are.
Right.
When a drug keeps binding to its receptors, it throws that balance off.
Yeah.
So the cells might, you know, reduce the number of those receptors to compensate, making them less sensitive to the drug, like turning down the volume on a speaker. The music's still there, but it's not as loud.
So it's not just about the drug itself, but how it messes with our body's natural chemistry.
Exactly. And this brings us to withdrawal, which is basically your body's way of saying, hey, where's that drug I'm used to?
Right. Withdrawal symptoms can be pretty rough.
They can be very unpleasant. And what's interesting is the symptoms are often the opposite of the drug's effects.
Oh, really?
So someone coming off a stimulant,
like cocaine,
might feel tired and depressed.
Mm.
While someone withdrawing from alcohol, a depressant, might experience anxiety and tremors.
So the body's trying to like recalibrate itself after being thrown out of whack.
Exactly. And how bad the withdrawal is, it really depends on the drug, the dose, and how quickly it's removed.
Okay, so we've talked about tolerance and withdrawal. Now let's get to addiction. This is where things get really complex, right?
Absolutely. Addiction is a chronic relapsing brain disease.
The disease, okay.
It's marked by an intense craving for the drug and an inability to control its use, even when bad things happen because of it.
So it's not just a matter of willpower.
It's not.
There are actual changes happening in the brain that are driving these behaviors.
Exactly. And one of the main explanations is the dopamine hypothesis.
Dopamine.
This theory says that addictive drugs basically hijack the brain's reward system, flooding it with dopamine.
And dopamine is the neurotransmitter linked to pleasure and reward, right?
Yes. It's all about motivation, pleasure, and feeling good when you do something.
Right.
Addictive drugs cause a huge sudden surge of dopamine, way bigger than what we get from natural rewards, like eating or achieving a goal.
So it's like hitting the reward button in the brain over and over.
Exactly. And over time,
yeah,
this rewires the brain,
wow,
making it harder and harder to resist craving the drug.
Oh, so it's this feedback loop where the more you use, the more you want it, and the harder it is to stop.
Exactly. And it's important to note that not all drugs are equally addictive.
Right, right.
Some, like heroin and cocaine, they're very addictive. Others, like marijuana, have a lower potential.
So it's not just the dopamine surge. Other factors must be involved, too.
Absolutely. How the drug gets in your system, how often you use it, and things specific to your genes, any mental health conditions you might have, they all play a role.
You mentioned earlier that addiction can even happen with prescription meds.
Yeah.
Can you give us some example?
Sure. Opioid painkillers, like oxycodone and hydrocodone, they can be very addictive. If you use them for a long time, even as prescribed, your body can become dependent. And then stopping, well, that leads to withdrawal.
That's a tough situation. You need the meds for pain.
Yeah.
But then you become reliant on them, and quitting is incredibly hard.
Exactly. That's why it's so important to use those meds carefully under a doctor's supervision and only when you absolutely need them.
This is all so complex. Substance use disorders, they're way more than just making bad choices.
Absolutely. It's this interplay of biology, psychology, and social factors.
You mentioned cross-tolerance earlier.
Yes.
How does that tie into treating alcohol withdrawal?
Great question. Cross-tolerance is when tolerance to one drug makes you tolerant to another drug that works similarly in your body.
Okay.
With alcohol withdrawal, we sometimes use benzodiazepines. They're central nervous system depressants, just like alcohol.
Okay.
They can help manage those really dangerous withdrawal symptoms.
So it's like using a similar but safer drug to help ease someone off alcohol.
Exactly. But benzodiazepines, they can also be addictive, so they're used very carefully and only under a doctor's care.
This deep dive into SUDs has been really eye-opening. What would you say are the key takeaways?
First, SUD is a medical condition, not a moral failing. It's driven by changes in the brain and all sorts of other factors.
It's not about willpower. It's about understanding what's happening in the brain.
Exactly. Second, tolerance, withdrawal, and addiction. They're all connected,
right,
feeding that cycle of dependence.
Mm-hmm.
And lastly, remember that SUD can happen with both prescription and non-prescription drugs.
Yeah.
That's why responsible use and effective treatments are so crucial.
This has been a heavy but super important conversation. I feel like I understand the science behind substance use disorders so much better now.
I'm glad to hear that. It's a tough topic, but there is hope.
Yeah.
Research is always leading to new discoveries and treatments.
It sounds like we're just starting to understand how our brains react to these substances.
We are. The brain is incredibly complex, and every new discovery helps us better understand how drugs affect it.
Right.
But that's a conversation for another deep dive.
Huh, for sure. This deep dive into SUDs has been fascinating. Now, I'm curious about those immediate effects some drugs have on the central nervous system. Mm. You know, the highs and lows. Let's move on and explore stimulants and depressants. We're back for the final part of our nervous system pharmacology deep dive.
It's been a wild ride for sure, from the autonomic and somatic systems to substance use disorders.
Yeah, and you know what I find really fascinating?
Yeah.
It's those immediate effects some drugs have on our central nervous system, you know? The highs and lows that can totally change how we feel and think.
That's a great point. And that's exactly what we're going to explore now, the world of CNS stimulants and depressants.
All right, let's start with the stimulants. These are the drugs that kind of like rev up the central nervous system, right?
Exactly.
Coffee, energy drinks, and some less legal stuff that give people that energy boost.
Right. CNS stimulants, they basically increase activity in the brain.
Okay.
Leads to all sorts of effects,
yeah,
like feeling more alert, energized, focused.
Right.
They can also boost your mood, make you less hungry, and even speed up your heart rate and blood pressure.
So it's like putting your brain into overdrive.
In a way, yeah. And these stimulants, they work in different ways.
Okay.
But often by increasing the levels of certain neurotransmitters in the brain.
Like dopamine and norepinephrine. We keep running into those guys.
They're essential for how our nervous system works. And as we've seen, messing with their levels can have some pretty big effects on both our body and mind.
Okay, so what are some examples of these CNS stimulants? The legal and the not so legal ones.
Well, caffeine's probably the most common stimulant worldwide. Coffee, tea, chocolate, even some meds have it.
Right.
Then there's nicotine found in tobacco products, another highly addictive stimulant.
So caffeine and nicotine, those are the everyday stimulants that people use to wake up or stay focused, right? But what about the stronger stuff, the ones that can be abused?
Well, amphetamines and cocaine are two examples. They're illicit stimulants, and they can be very addictive.
Okay.
They cause really intense feelings of euphoria and energy.
Right.
But they come with some serious downsides, like heart problems, anxiety, even psychosis.
So it's like high risk, high reward. The initial effects might seem great, but the long-term consequences can be pretty bad.
Exactly. That's why it's so important to know the risks and get help if you're struggling with any of these substances.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's stimulants. Now let's talk about CNS depressants. Those are the ones that slow down brain activity, right?
Exactly. They do the opposite of stimulants.
Okay.
They decrease brain activity, which leads to feelings of relaxation, drowsiness, reduced anxiety.
So if stimulants are overdrive, depressants are like chilling out.
That's a perfect way to put it. And like stimulants, they work in a bunch of different ways.
Okay.
But often by boosting the effects of inhibitory neurotransmitters like GABA.
GABA, our brain's natural chill pill.
You got it. And there are a ton of CNS depressants out there, each with its own level of potency and risk.
Okay, so give me some examples of commonly used CNS depressants.
Well, alcohol is probably the most well-known.
Yeah.
It's everywhere. But as we know, it can be highly addictive and damaging.
Right. Alcohol might seem harmless at first, but it can quickly lead to dependence and a lot of health problems.
Definitely. Then there are benzodiazepines.
Okay.
They're often prescribed for anxiety and insomnia. They're generally safer than alcohol, but you can still become dependent on them if you use them for a long time.
So using them responsibly under a doctor's care is important.
Absolutely. And we can't forget about barbiturates. They're another type of CNS depressant.
Right.
They were used a lot in the past, but now we have safer options, mostly because barbiturates have a high risk of overdose and some pretty nasty side effects.
So it's like a spectrum of depressants, from alcohol, which is readily available but risky, to barbiturates, which are much more potent and controlled.
That's a good way to think about it. And it's really important to remember that mixing CNS depressants can be incredibly dangerous.
Yeah, like alcohol and sleeping pills.
Exactly. The combined effects can cause serious problems like slowing down your breathing, coma, even death.
It's just not worth the risk.
Not at all. Always be careful about potential interactions and talk to a doctor if you have any questions about your meds.
This deep dive has been amazing. I feel like I have a whole new understanding of how complex our brains are and how drugs can affect the way we think, feel, and act.
It's a lot to take in, right? The nervous system is a fascinating and intricate network, and we're always learning more about how it works.
Yeah, it's incredible. We've covered so much ground, from the basics of neurotransmission to substance use disorders, stimulants, and depressants.
Definitely a lot to think about.
I'm leaving with a newfound appreciation for, like, the power of pharmacology.
And I hope you're leaving with a sense of curiosity, too. There's so much more to discover in this field.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into nervous system pharmacology. Until next time, keep exploring and stay curious.